I want you to picture a modern city skyline at night. You see the office towers lit up, the street lamps tracing the roads, the data centers just kind of humming away.
Hospitals running life support systems 24/7.
Right, exactly. We always talk about the electricity powering all of that, the generation, the renewables, the grid itself, but we rarely talk about the actual brain that is controlling that power inside the building.
We treat it like invisible infrastructure.
We really do.
It's a great way to put it, honestly. I mean, we flip a switch and the light goes on, we plug in a server and it hums. But between the power plant and that light bulb, there are these critical metal boxes.
Switchgear and control gear.
Exactly. And they're making thousands of decisions, managing loads, and essentially preventing the wires in your walls from turning into heating elements.
Which is exactly why today our mission for this deep dive is to open up those boxes. We are tackling a set of documents that literally keeps the lights on without burning the building down, which is the IEC 61439 standard.
And for our listeners down in Australia and New Zealand, we're also looking at its local sibling, ASNZS 61439.
Yeah, and I know hearing IEC standard might make some of you reach for the skip button, but stick with us here.
Please do, because this isn't just about regulatory red tape or checking boxes on a clipboard. This is about the physics of safety.
Right.
We're talking about low voltage assemblies, so anything up to 1,000 volts AC or 1,500 volts DC, this standard is the global benchmark for making sure those assemblies don't explode, melt, or shock anyone when things go sideways.
And there has been a pretty massive philosophical shift in how the industry handles this, hasn't there? I was looking at the notes, and apparently a lot of people are still Googling IEC 439.
They are, yeah, and they're looking for a ghost. IEC 60439 is the old standard. It's gone.
Replaced by 61439.
Right, and the difference isn't just a digit in the file name. The old standard relied heavily on this really binary concept of type-tested assemblies versus partially type-tested.
Which led to issues.
A lot of gray areas, yeah. People would extrapolate data they probably shouldn't have.
It felt a bit like checking a box. Like, did it survive? Yes. Good. Whereas the new standard seems to demand a much deeper understanding of what's actually happening inside the cabinet.
Precisely. IEC 61439 moves away from just testing and introduces this comprehensive design verification framework.
Which means?
It acknowledges that you can't just build one perfect prototype and assume everything else you build from that point on is fine. You have to verify the design rules themselves.
It sounds kind of like the difference between checking if a car engine starts versus actually engineering the engine to understand its absolute limits.
That is a perfect analogy.
Yeah.
The goal isn't just compliance, it's verification. We need to prove that a box full of electricity, which, let's be honest, desperately wants to escape, is contained safely under all conditions.
So let's unpack this design verification concept, because this is the core philosophy here. In the old days, you built one, blew it up in a lab, and if it survived, you were good.
Right.
How does the new standard handle the reality that manufacturers can't physically destroy every single variation of a switchboard?
That's the billion-dollar question. If you had to destructively test every custom panel, the industry would just grind to a halt.
Mm.
So 61439 gives us three distinct, totally equivalent paths to verify a design.
Path number one being the classic one, right? The brute force method.
Yes. Verification by testing. This is the gold standard. You build a representative unit, you take it to a certified high-power laboratory, and you essentially torture it.
Sounds intense.
It is. You hit it with massive short-circuit currents. You crank up the heat to test temperature rise limits. You check the IP ratings by blasting it with dust and water. It provides the strongest evidence because it's empirical. It happened. You have the charred metal to prove it.
But that's incredibly expensive and slow. If I'm a manufacturer and I just want to, I don't know, move a breaker 3 inches to the left or use a slightly different bracket, surely I don't have to retest the whole thing.
Exactly. And that is where the standard gets practical. That leads us to the second path, which is verification by comparison to a reference design. This allows you to take a new design and compare it to a reference design that has already been tested.
So I can just copy my homework?
Only if your homework is strictly harder than the original.
Ah, got it.
The rules are very rigid here. The new design must be equal to or more demanding than the tested one.
Give me an example of that.
Sure. Regarding heat, you can't use a smaller enclosure because a smaller box traps more heat.
Makes sense.
You can't have higher power loss components. But if the enclosure is the same size or larger, and the heat generated is the same or less, you can verify it by comparison without booking a lab slot.
That's entirely logical. If the tough version survived, the easier version will too. What about the third path?
Verification by assessment. This is basically calculation, using strict engineering rules and physics to demonstrate compliance.
Math to the rescue?
Always. This is very common for things like temperature rise in custom panels where the geometry is totally unique. You calculate the total power loss, you look at the effective cooling surface area of the cabinet, and you calculate if the heat can dissipate fast enough.
So in the real world, is a project usually just one of these? Do you just pick path three and do the math for everything?
Rarely.
Hmm.
Most complex projects use a hybrid approach. You might use testing for the enclosure's ability to withstand a short circuit because the magnetic forces are chaotic and really hard to calculate.
Right, unpredictable.
Exactly. Then you use comparison for the busbar arrangement because it's structurally similar to a previous job you did.
Yeah.
And then you use assessment to calculate the temperature rise because the specific mix of circuit breakers is unique to the specific client.
It's a mix and match approach, provided you have the actual evidence for each piece.
Exactly.
That covers the design phase. But there's another layer to this, right? Because just because the design on paper is good, that doesn't mean the technician on the workshop floor tightened every screw correctly.
Precisely. And this is where we have to distinguish between design verification and routine verification. Design verification is done once for that specific configuration concept. Routine verification must be done on every single assembly before it leaves the workshop. It's the every single time rule.
This sounds a lot like the pre-flight check a pilot does. It doesn't matter if the plane flew perfectly yesterday, you check it again today.
It is exactly like that. It's mandatory. You can't just say the prototype worked, so this one is fine. You have a strict checklist. You're doing a visual inspection of the wiring and terminal torques.
Mechanical stuff too.
Oh yeah, physically operating the mechanical doors and interlocks. You're doing a dielectric withstand test, so hitting it with high voltage to make sure there's no leakage current jumping gaps. And crucially, you are checking protective earth continuity.
And I noticed the source material really emphasized traceability here. It's not just about doing the test, it's about proving you did it for that specific box.
Huge emphasis on that. You can't just have a generic pass stamp. The records must be linked to the specific serial number of the unit.
So no generic paperwork.
None. If a panel fails in the field 5 years from now, you need to be able to pull the file and say, on February 22nd, 2026, we tested this specific unit, serial number 12345, and the earth continuity was exactly 0.05 ohms.
That accountability is key. Now let's transition to what the source material calls the technically demanding part of the standard, which is temperature rise. This seems to be where a lot of designs actually fail.
Absolutely. Heat is the absolute enemy of electronics and electrical connections. Heat increases resistance, which creates more heat, which can lead to thermal runaway.
And there's a nuance here that I found really interesting. The standard doesn't talk about degrees Celsius in the way we usually check the weather. It talks about Kelvin.
Right. It focuses on the Kelvin rise above ambient, or delta T. This is crucial because absolute temperature varies.
How so?
Well, if you say a bus bar has a limit of 105 degrees Celsius, well, is that in a cool server room or a metal box baking in the direct sun?
Oh, I see.
So the standard says, for example, a bare copper bus bar has a limit of a 70K rise.
Okay, help me do the math here. If the ambient room temperature is 35 degrees Celsius,
then the bus bar acts as the baseline plus the rise. So 35 plus 70 equals 105 degrees absolute temperature.
But if the room is hotter?
Exactly. If you were in a hotter room, say 45 degrees, that same 70K rise puts you at 115 degrees absolute. That might be hot enough to melt the insulation on a nearby cable or falsely trip a sensitive breaker. By focusing on the rise, it forces you to account for the environment.
I really like the analogy of a heat budget. It feels a lot like managing finances.
It really is. Every component in that box, the breakers, the cables, the copper bars, they all have internal resistance. When current flows, that resistance generates heat. Those are your I squared R losses.
So that's your expenditure.
Right. And the enclosure surface area and airflow are your income. They get rid of the heat to balance the budget. If you generate more heat than the box can shed, the temperature inside spirals up until failure.
And this brings us to a term that I think saves a lot of money but confuses a lot of people, the rated diversity factor, or RDF.
The RDF is basically a reality check. Imagine a huge distribution board with 10 outgoing circuits. Are all 10 of them going to be pulling maximum current at exactly the same second?
Probably not, unless everyone in the building turns on the microwave, the AC, and the hairdryer at the exact same moment.
Exactly. So the standard allows you to apply a diversity factor. An RDF of 0.8 means you are designing for 80% of the total potential load running simultaneously.
which prevents massive over-engineering.
Right. You don't need copper bars the size of tree trunks if the physics of the building dictate you'll never use that much power at once. But, this is critical, if you claim an RDF of 1.0, meaning 100% load, you better have a very robust thermal design to back it up.
So it's about being realistic with how the building will actually be used. Now, from heat, let's move to the more violent side of electricity, the short circuit ratings. This section was a bit of an alphabet soup in the notes. ICW, IPK, ICW, can we decode these?
Oh, it was the most misunderstood part of the standard, hands down. Let's break it down.
Let's start with ICW, rated short time withstand.
Think of anchors as the tough guy rating. This is the amount of current the panel can hold for a specific time, usually 1 second, sometimes 3 seconds, without any help.
No fuses blowing.
No fuses blowing, no breakers tripping upstream. It just sits there and takes the full force of the fault current without melting or deforming. It is an unconditional rating.
Okay, so that's the raw endurance. Then what is IPCO?
IPCO is the rated peak withstand. This deals with the physics of force. When a short circuit first happens before the current settles down, there is a massive instantaneous spike.
Like a shockwave.
Yes, and it creates immense magnetic fields that literally try to push the copper bars apart. IPU measures the panel's ability to not physically rip itself apart during that split-second magnetic slam. It's usually a multiple of the IPUN.
So IQ is thermal endurance and IPIC is mechanical impact strength. Now, what about the last one, IPQ, the conditional short circuit rating?
IPIC is the team player rating. This rating says, I can handle this massive fault, but only if there's a specific fuse or breaker upstream that cuts the power quickly. It's conditional.
This sounds much more common for cost-effective designs where you don't really need those tough guy levels of endurance.
It is. If you know you have a fast-acting fuse protecting the panel, you don't need to build the bus bars to survive a full second of terror. You just need them to survive the few milliseconds it takes for the fuse to blow.
Makes sense.
But, and this is a huge but, you must record the let-through energy of that protective device.
Meaning you need to prove that the specific fuse you chose is actually fast enough?
Correct. You have to prove that the energy the fuse lets through before it pops is less than what your panel can handle. No assumptions allowed in 61439. You need the data sheets.
Okay, let's look inside the box now. We're talking about safety geometry. The standard has these forms of separation. It sounds like we're categorizing prison cells.
Well, in a way, we are imprisoning the arc flash. The form tells you how much internal segregation exists inside the panel. It ranges from Form 1 to Form 4.
Form 1 is the open party, right?
Yes. Form 1 means no internal barriers.
Right.
The bus bars, the breakers, the terminals, they're all in the exact same space. If you drop a wrench, it could hit anything. It's fine for small, simple distribution boards where you just turn the whole thing off to work on it.
And then you step up to Form 3 or 4.
Right. Form 3B, 4A, 4B, these involve high separation. The idea is to isolate the bus bars from the functional units, which are the breakers, and the functional units from the terminals where you connect the cables.
Totally compartmentalized.
Yeah, exactly. In a Form 4B assembly, everything's in its own little cell. If you are working on the terminals for circuit A, you are physically blocked from touching the bus bar or the terminals for circuit B.
So it prevents an arc from propagating, and it keeps the maintenance personnel safe from accidental contact.
It contains the catastrophe to a single cell.
Now, on the microscopic level of geometry, we have creepage and clearance. To me, these sound like the exact same thing, distance, but the standard treats them very differently.
They are crucial to preventing electrical breakdown, but they are different. Clearance is the shortest distance through the air. Imagine an ant jumping from one conductive part to another. That's clearance.
Jumping the gap.
Right. It's determined by the voltage and the risk of overvoltage spikes.
And creepage.
Creepage is the shortest path along the surface of the insulation. So imagine that ant walking along the plastic surface from one conductor to the other.
Why does the surface path matter so much? Can't the electricity just jump?
Because surfaces get dirty. The standard talks about pollution degree. If you're in a dusty mine site, that dust can settle on the insulation.
And dust is conductive.
Especially if there's moisture, yes. That dust becomes conductive. It effectively creates a bridge, shortening the path. So in a dirty environment, like pollution degree 3 or 4, you need a much longer creepage distance than in a clean server room to prevent tracking.
And the material matters too, right? I saw CTI mentioned in the sources.
Yes, the comparative tracking index. Some materials resist tracking, which is that little path of carbon that forms when electricity crawls across the surface better than others.
So better materials mean less distance needed.
Exactly. High CTI materials allow you to design with shorter creepage distances because the material itself fights the formation of that conductive path.
Fascinating. It really is a game of millimeters. Now, I want to shift gears to a specific geography. We mentioned at the start that we're also looking at ASNZS 61439 for our listeners in Australia and New Zealand.
Yes, and this is where things can get tricky for international manufacturers. ASNZS 61439 is the local adoption of the IEC standard. The physics are the same, but the paperwork and the legal context are very different.
The big one here seems to be the RCM.
Correct. In Europe, you have the CE mark. In Australia and New Zealand, the CE mark means absolutely nothing legally. You need the RCM, the regulatory compliance mark.
And how do you get that?
To put that mark on a product, the supplier needs a supplier's declaration of conformity, or SDOC.
So if I'm a European manufacturer, and I have all this great IEC test data from a lab in Germany, can I use it? Or do I have to retest in Sydney?
You can use it. The laws of physics don't change when you cross the equator. You can use your IEC test data, but you must create a mapping document.
A mapping document?
Yeah, you have to show clause by clause that your IEC evidence meets the specific ASNZS requirements, including all the local deviations. You can't just throw a German test report on the desk and walk away.
And there's a trap, isn't there? The wiring rules.
Ah, yes. ASNZS 3000. This is the Bible for electricians in Australia and New Zealand. Here's the catch that burns people. You can build a panel that is perfectly compliant with IEC 61439 in the factory, but when it arrives on site, it might get completely rejected because it doesn't meet the access requirements of ASNZS 3000.
Access requirements, like physically standing in front of it.
Exactly. Minimum working space, door swing direction, location of the main switch handle.
So 61439 is about the box, but 3000 is about the human.
Precisely. IEC 61439 cares about the box performance. ASNZS 3000 cares about the human standing in front of it. If you send a panel where the handle is too high, or the door doesn't open fully because of the hinge design, you might have a technically compliant product that is completely illegal to install.
That is a massive distinction. One regulates the product, the other regulates the installation. And they have to talk to each other.
They absolutely do. Ignoring the installation context is a rookie mistake.
Before we wrap up, we have to talk about the people involved. The standard defines two key roles, the original manufacturer and the assembler. This seems to be where the liability lines are actually drawn. What is the difference?
This is the most critical liability boundary in the whole business. The original manufacturer, often the OEM, like a Siemens Schneider or ABB, designs the system. They do the verification, the destructive testing, the complex calculations. The assembler is a panel builder who buys the parts and puts it together.
So the assembler is really just following instructions?
Ideally, yes. If the assembler follows the OEM's instruction manual perfectly, they can piggyback on the OEM's verification. They don't need to retest. They're essentially a franchise, building the burger exactly how corporate says to build it.
But here's where it gets really interesting. What happens when the assembler goes rogue?
If the assembler decides to swap a device for a cheaper brand, or drills holes to change the bus bar layout, or squeezes it all into a smaller custom enclosure that the OEM didn't specify, they've just crossed the line.
So they aren't an assembler anymore.
Right. They're no longer just an assembler. They become the manufacturer in the eyes of the standard.
And that means they own the liability.
100%. They are now responsible for verifying that new design. They can't rely on the OEM certificate anymore because they've changed the design. They have to do the math or the comparison or the testing themselves.
That is a huge realization. I bet there are a lot of assemblers out there who don't realize they are actually manufacturers legally.
I guarantee it. One extra hole, one swap breaker, and you own the risk. If that panel fails, the OEM will look at it and say, we didn't design it that way.
Wow. So we've covered a lot today, from the death of IEC 60439 to the heat budget, the tough guy short circuit ratings, and the legal traps of the RCM.
It's a lot of ground, but I think the summary is pretty simple. IEC 61439 is not just red tape. It's a framework based on physics, heat, electricity, mechanics, all to ensure safety. It replaces guesswork with verification.
And for you, our listeners, whether you are buying these panels or building them, what's the practical takeaway?
If you are buying, ask for the design verification evidence. Don't just accept a certificate that says type tested, that's old language. Ask to see how the specific unit you are buying is verified. Is it by test, comparison, or assessment? And check the routine verification records.
And if you are building,
know your role. Are you the assembler or the manufacturer? If you modify the design, be ready to do the math or the testing to prove it's safe. Don't assume.
It brings us right back to that invisible infrastructure. We want it to stay invisible. We don't want to see it because it's on fire.
Exactly. A boring switchboard is a safe switchboard.
I'll leave you with this thought to mull over. In a world that demands more and more customization, where every client wants something special, how many businesses are unknowingly taking on full legal liability as manufacturers just because they drilled one extra hole to make a cable fit? Are you building a panel, or are you accepting liability for an explosion? Something to think about next time you walk past that gray electrical cabinet. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.
Stay safe out there.